From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. 5 days after the attack in Las Vegas, investigators are learning more now about whether the gunman had considered locations in other cities as targets, including Chicago and Boston. Joining us now is Casey Morell, reporter with KNPR in Las Vegas. Casey, what more do we know about the additional targets at this point?
Well, Jeremy, we know that Stephen Paddock, the accused gunman, had booked rooms near Lollapalooza in Chicago back in August. He also had booked a condo near the Life is Beautiful show, which is in downtown Las Vegas, last month. According to investigators, they have found some mention of Fenway Park in Boston as a potential target, but they're not providing any details further about that, just that they saw Fenway Park show up in some of the material that they found with Paddock.
And what about the investigation in general? What more are we learning about the gunman, about any potential motive?
Honestly, not a whole lot so far. Police here have been pretty quiet since their press conference on Wednesday. They're still trying to figure out exactly what the motive is, and if they have any further ideas, they're not sharing them so far. One thing that we have seen in reports is that authorities are trying to figure out if Stephen Paddock wanted to make a car bomb or something similar. They found a lot of explosive devices, or explosive material rather, in his vehicles, 50 pounds of tannerite, which is a substance in rifle targets that explode, according to the Associated Press. They also found ammonium nitrate, which is a fertilizer that you can use to make explosives, in his car at Mandalay Bay. So they're trying to figure out exactly why he possessed that, what his intent was with those materials as well.
Now, there was an observation that I wanted to share from Rukmini Kalamaki, who's a correspondent covering ISIS for the New York Times. And she tweeted a thread yesterday about ISIS claiming the Vegas massacre and that she was waiting for ISIS to release their weekly newsletter to see if anything new emerged. And they did, in fact, share a picture that shows Mandalay Bay drenched in blood. And they claim that the gunman in the massacre converted to Islam 6 months ago. Now, again, there's no proof of that at this point. And the FBI had said the other day there's no connection that they know of to international terrorism. But what are you hearing about that? Is that something that's being talked about?
Yeah, I saw the thread that you're talking about yesterday, and it recalls a conversation that we actually had on this program Monday with your colleague Tom Jelton, who said that it seems a little speculative considering the Islamic State is not really a big fan of gambling or of death by suicide.
Right.
So, you know, it's one of those things that I think people are still trying to just figure out what the motivation for this attack was. And in that vacuum of information, people are starting to speculate one way or the other. People, I think, are talking about it, but without any further concrete information here on the ground, we really just don't know yet. We're still trying to figure out what happened, really, and just trying to parse our minds to that. You know, the list of the total number of victims came out last night, and I think people are just really now starting to come to terms with what has happened. And,
yeah,
and from there, we'll go from there.
Casey, it's been about 5 days since this attack. What does it feel like there in Las Vegas today?
You start to feel the sorrow of the initial attack fade into anger and questioning why this is happening. Like you said, you know, it's so difficult because motivation just is not known at this time. So people are trying to come to terms with what has happened, and it's a lot harder to rationalize it or reconcile it when we honestly have no idea right now. You know, we started to see some more of the vigils take place last night. We saw a man from Illinois drive to Las Vegas to put up 58 crosses, one for each of the victims of the shooting. And I think that people are just trying to understand this as best as they can. And when I say as best as they can, it's hard to come up with an idea of what best even would be in this situation. Mm. I think people are just still in a state of shock, and that's not going to wear off for a while.
That's Casey Morell, a reporter with KNPR in Las Vegas. Casey, thank you so much.
Always.
Well, this week we learned the names and are slowly and excruciatingly learning about the lives of the 58 people murdered in Las Vegas. One of them was Stacey Echebert, a stylist and mom from Novata, California. Dana Cronin from member station KQED attended a vigil for her.
Let's pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Those who knew Stacey describe her with one adjective, fiery.
If Stacey was here tonight, we would hear her say, "Hey, Toots, I got you. Hold on."
San Ramon Elementary School principal Amanda Langford says Stacey loved her sports. The 50-year-old was usually the loudest in the bleachers, her two-finger whistle a familiar sound to the crowd. The wife of a San Francisco police officer and mother of two, she made a mean vegetarian chili. She was tough and loved fiercely, her family and friends say.
We're all here together and in the presence of Stacey's family, and I want us all to simply tell them and one another that we choose love and that we're here with them. So will you do that with me on three? Will you say, "We choose love and we are here with you"?
We choose love and we are here with you.
The smell of burning candles filled the air as Pastor Joe Everly spoke at the elementary school where the vigil took place. The memorial drew hundreds. Stacey's brother-in-law, Al Echebert, says the vigil's turnout was a testament to the community Stacey fostered.
On my way here, you can see people walking out of their homes and walking to this event here. And it's just amazing. And if anything, you know, it's hopefully going to bring the community closer together.
Underneath a flag at half-staff, the Novato community exchanged long hugs and wiped tears from each other's cheeks. For Here and Now, I'm Dana Cronin in Novato.
Well, it was 10 years ago that Hamas forced Palestinian Authority leaders out of the Gaza Strip and took control of the territory. Now the two sides are talking about letting the Palestinian Authority take control again, finally bringing the Gaza Strip and the West Bank under one leadership. The prospect has brought unusual hope to Palestinians. NPR's Daniel Estrin was in Gaza when the Palestinian Authority leadership drove in from the West Bank.
Gaza has not seen a celebration like this in a long time. Hundreds of Palestinians are gathered at the border between Israel and Gaza as the Palestinian Authority government, the ministers from the West Bank, are driving into Gaza. Gazans are crowded around their cars. They're cheering.
It's just like a historical moment. You cannot imagine how happy we are. We are full of hope now.
Gaza resident Subhi Al-Atawna says life in Gaza has been terrible these last 10 years. When Hamas took over the territory, Israel and Egypt imposed a blockade. Today, jobs are scarce, and services like electricity and water are unreliable. He thinks life would improve if the Palestinian Authority takes control over Gaza again, because it has international backing. Palestinian Authority leaders paid a short visit to Gaza. There were photo ops and tours. Many visited their old ministry buildings, which were taken over by Hamas 10 years ago. Palestinian Authority Communications Minister Alam Musa inspected telecoms equipment, and he was upbeat.
We need to talk about the future, not about the past. I can say very clearly that I see only positive attitudes, and hopefully we'll be able to practice our role for the development of the society in Gaza as well.
The rival Palestinian groups have tried many times to reconcile, but the chances may be better now. Hamas has lost the support of many Arab countries and has turned to Egypt, which is pressing hard for a deal. Hamas has a new leader who says he won't let anyone sabotage the effort. But there are some very local issues to work out, like jobs. This man, Yasser Mohanna, says he was working in the communications ministry in Gaza when Hamas kicked out the Palestinian Authority and took over. He collected his pen, his notebooks, his coffee kit, and left. The Palestinian Authority has been paying tens of thousands of civil servants to stay at home and boycott Hamas. So Hamas hired its own civil servants to replace them. Mohanna says he and his old colleagues have been told to get ready to take back their old jobs. But what about the Hamas workers in their seats? Would there be violence if tens of thousands of them are suddenly kicked out? But perhaps the biggest question is about Hamas's weapons. This is Palestinian political analyst Mukhemar Abu Sada.
We have tens of thousands of resistance fighters in Gaza who belong to Hamas and other Palestinian groups. Are we going to witness one authority, one law, and one weapon?
Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas says Hamas must dismantle its military wing, a steep demand Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem says it can't accept. He says Hamas is a resistance movement committed to armed struggle against Israel. Abbas is different. He supports negotiations with Israel, brokered by the Trump administration, which wants the Palestinian Authority in charge of Gaza again. For its part, Israel is wary. It says any deal among Palestinians must require the group to give up its guns. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Gaza.
Fake news is in the news. Yesterday, Arizona Congressman Paul Gosar repeated the discounted theory that left-leaning activist George Soros funded the white supremacists in the Charlottesville rally to gin up race issues, that as a young Jew in Hungary, Soros collaborated with Nazis, both fake stories spread by alt-right radio's Alex Jones. Well, there's also fake news about the Las Vegas shooting. Kate Somers-Dawes is deputy managing editor of Mashable, here for our weekly social media roundup. Kate, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
So, Kate, what you thought was interesting on social media, and it is also reprehensible, is that there are a lot of people who thought that Las Vegas didn't really happen, that it was a false flag being an event that's, you know, like a flag planted to deceive, to make it look as if something happened, usually by the government. Who was saying this, and what was the nature of the false flag on social media?
You saw this term sort of start to spread really quickly after the events in Las Vegas, and not long after they happened on Sunday night, YouTube's algorithm, for instance, quickly added the term false flag to its search terms about Las Vegas. So if you were going into YouTube and putting that term in, then false flag would come up and return videos spreading this conspiracy theory that the shooting wasn't real. I'm looking at a screenshot of a video that has images from Las Vegas that say, Las Vegas shooting, an Illuminati masterminded agenda, no doubt about it, with an exclamation point.
And do we know if people like conspiracy theorist Alex Jones were behind this? Because he also thought that Newtown, the Sandy Hook school shooting, was a false flag, never happened.
It's very hard to know where these terms initially come from. We do have reports that he was using the term false flag on his radio show. But there's also a, you know, kind of rampant misinformation on the message board 4chan, which is sort of a dark corner of the internet that was pushing all kinds of false narratives around Las Vegas. It's hard to tell where they start, but they very quickly snowball and end up in places like YouTube at the very top of Facebook's trending topics.
No, it's obscene. I mean, ask the families of the 58 who died and the 500 injured if this was a false flag. Let's move on to news yesterday that film producer and studio exec Harvey Weinstein settled claims of sexual harassment over several decades. What's been some of the reaction?
The reaction has been swift and fierce. Some celebrities, it's obviously a difficult position for a woman in Hollywood to be in, to speak out about this kind of abuse, given how powerful Harvey Weinstein is and how successful he is. But a few celebrity women have tweeted about it. America Ferrera tweeted yesterday, "The abuse of power must be called out, however powerful the abuser, and we must publicly stand with those brave enough to come forward." There's also a really interesting thread that is gaining steam on Twitter. A woman named Anne Donahue wrote, "When did you meet your Harvey Weinstein? I'll go first. I was a 17-year-old co-op student, and he insisted on massaging my shoulders as I typed." And the interesting thing about that message is there are scores of women responding to her. It's a sobering read.
By the way, there's also a tweet from Yasher Ali to Michael Moore. "Any word on your friend and business partner, Harvey Weinstein? You've had no problem tweeting about O'Reilly and others on the right. Harvey Weinstein seemed to be on the left." So interesting challenge there. Carolina Panthers quarterback Cam Newton kind of stepped in it after he had an exchange with a Charlotte Observer female reporter. The first voice we hear is that reporter. Let's listen.
Devin Funchess has seemed to really embrace the physicality of his routes and getting those extra yards. Does that give you a little bit of an enjoyment to see him kind of truck sticking people out there?
It's funny to hear a female talk about routes. Like, it's funny.
He thought it was funny. Many female reporters didn't.
That's right. No female reporter that I could found that funny. And they responded in kind on Twitter. Andrea Adelson, who's from ESPN, wrote, "Every female sports reporter has encountered a Neanderthal like Cam Newton over the course of her career. They go low, we go high." Another reporter from ESPN, Catherine Terrell, wrote, "What frustrates me about Cam Newton's comments? He's not joking around with friends. He's being condescending to a reporter." Jordan Rodrigue, who was the reporter who asked the question, quickly tweeted, "I don't think it's, quote, funny to be a female and talk about routes. I think it's my job."
And we're going to end on a light note because we need it. On Monday, one of our colleagues, NPR editor Christopher Dean Hopkins, accidentally used NPR's Facebook account to tweet out about what people thought was his cat named Ramona. The tweets were, "Ramona's given new toy, smiles, examines for 20 seconds, discards. Ramona gets a hug, acquiesces momentarily, squirms to be put down. Ramona sees three cats 30 feet away, shrieks." What really happened and what was the response?
It actually has a twist ending. Many folks thought that it was about his cat. The post is about a baby. We're assuming his baby. The internet loves babies. The internet loves cats. The last time I looked, there were 84,000 reactions to that post, 6,400 comments, and people just responded with joy. One user wrote, "This is so much better than the depressing news lately. Can Ramona updates be a new NPR feature?" And then they wrote, "Also, is Ramona going to get a cat? I think she needs a cat."
Somebody else wrote, "This is the best way to accidentally post on your employer's social media account."
That's right.
Kate Summers-Dawes, Deputy Managing Editor of Mashable, will link to everything at hearnow.org. Kate, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, from social media to older media, they're back.
"You and I need to talk."
"I disagree. I think you and I need to talk."
"What are you doing here, Grace?"
"What are you doing here, Will?"
"Are you just going to repeat everything I say with an emphasis on a different word?"
"Are you just going to repeat everything I say with an emphasis on a different word?"
A moment from NBC's reboot of Will and Grace, one of dozens of new shows premiering on networks and streaming services in the past few weeks. It's the fall. NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans has the enviable job of keeping up with all of them, and he joins us to guide us through. And so, Eric, Will and Grace, love this show, but what's the sense of the reboot?
You know, I'm not a huge fan of the reboot. I do think that it kind of recaptures some of the rhythms of the original series. It's just not as sharp as the show was at its when it was at its creative height. Mm-hmm. But what I've seen happen with these shows that are rolling out now is that people seem to need comfort food from their television right now. There's a lot of scary things sort of going on in the world, from the Las Vegas shootings to the turmoil that we've had in government, you know, most of this year. And so a show like Will and Grace, it seems to be doing well in the ratings, even though critics didn't necessarily love the first three episodes, because it's comforting and it's something people recognize. And there's other new shows like Young Sheldon on CBS, which is a spinoff of The Big Bang Theory, and a show called The Good Doctor on ABC, which is this heartwarming drama about an autistic surgical resident who's trying to make his way in his first posting at a hospital. These are shows that can feel a little like comfort food, and they seem to be doing well. And maybe there's a sense that people want something that is comforting, and they're not as interested in some of the dark and gritty things that maybe we're used to seeing from quality television.
Right. It's your visual mashed potatoes, and people want them. Well, but what about shows that you know aren't just, you know, blankies for people, but really have made a positive impression on you?
Well, I really loved HBO's new show, The Deuce, about the emergence and the transformation of porn from sort of an illegal venture into a real industry in New York City. And this show got picked up for a second season, I think, after the first or second episode aired on HBO. So obviously, HBO liked it. Mm-hmm. And we've even got a clip from the show that's set in the 1970s and talks about the emergence of the porn industry here. James Franco is actually playing two parts. He's playing twin brothers, and they're both talking about one of the twins' decision to leave his wife. Let's check it out.
"I'm done. Out for good."
"You sure?"
"Positive."
"I don't want to say nothing bad about your wife, have you two get back together and have you mad at me forever."
"Marriage is dead. Say what you feel."
"Dead?"
"Yeah."
"Like for real dead?"
"Dead, dead."
"100%.
100%.
Never going back?"
"Yes."
That's, I mean, to think that that's the same actor. And Maggie Gyllenhaal is in this too, as she plays a prostitute.
And she plays a prostitute who realizes that making films is a way to get off the street, make her life a lot less dangerous, and she becomes a porn director. So, you know, it's all the things that you like about quality TV these days. It's a complex subject. It's something that's authentic and detailed. It's about a period in history that maybe, you know, we could stand and learn a little bit more about. I think it's very well done. What's been interesting to me about this season is that the fall season, especially on the broadcast networks, has been a little lackluster. There haven't been a lot of shows that critics have loved. But if there's a sense that people want comfort food and maybe they don't want shows that will challenge them as much as a show like The Deuce, then maybe there's a sense that the networks actually made the right move in doing so many spinoffs and reboots and shows that aren't particularly challenging.
Yeah. Okay. It's early days, but are there shows in trouble?
Well, you know, Kira Sedgwick had a show called 10 Days in the Valley that bowed to some disappointing ratings. And overall, actually, the LA Times had a great story that talked about how the overall ratings for the big five networks are down 11% this year versus the same time last year. Now, the CW hasn't yet really debuted its new programming. That starts to roll out next week when we see shows like Supergirl come back, and they have a reboot of Dynasty that's gotten some decent reviews, and they also have a military-themed drama called Valor. So that may change a little bit once the CW starts to roll out its original programming. But there is a sense that people are starting to consume things in different ways. They're going to streaming. They're DVRing things and taking time to watch things. So it'll take us a little while to really get a full picture about how these shows are performing. But some of these shows are doing better than people expected. The Good Doctor was picked up for a full season. Young Sheldon was also picked up for a full season. Mm-hmm. And we also last year saw the networks be very stingy about cancellations. So I expect these shows to get some time to prove themselves, and they seem to be doing an okay job, most of them so far.
NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
The jobs numbers today were expected to be bad because of weather in Houston and Florida, and they are. 33,000 jobs lost last month, according to the Labor Department. At the same time, the unemployment rate dropped to 4.2%, its lowest since February 2001. We're joined now by Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, to take a look at this. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Robin.
Now, those numbers don't include Puerto Rico or the U.S. Virgin Islands, devastated, of course, by Hurricane Maria. And everyone knew Harvey and Irma would throw off the numbers, but this is a bad number, isn't it?
On the surface, it appears to be a very bad number. You know, we haven't had a month where we've lost jobs in about 7 years, back when the economy was still sort of sputtering back to life after the recession. But like you said, the hurricane, the two hurricanes really skew these numbers dramatically. Right. Economists, their estimates were all over the map in our survey, from as low as a loss of 45,000 jobs to as high as a gain of 260,000 jobs. Mm. So it's amazing how no one really knows the impact of a hurricane until after the fact. And these numbers will probably be revised in future months. So they're worth taking with a grain of salt.
Sure. I mean, is it important to note that sometimes when you have weather-devastated areas, the rebuilding spikes the job numbers on the other side?
Right. And I think that's part of the reason why the disparity in the estimates before it. And certainly in the coming months, it would not be surprising to see very, very strong numbers because of people hired to, you know, fix the damage and to rebuild.
Right. Well, still talk about where were these losses, especially in, you know, because of Irma and Harvey.
Well, they don't give you necessarily a geographical breakdown.
Right.
One of the big sectors to lose jobs was bars and restaurants. They lost about 105,000 jobs. And that sort of makes sense when you think about how almost all of those jobs are hourly rather than salary. So if a restaurant closes down temporarily, the jobs are accounted for as being lost. But this is a sector that's really been one of the highlights of job growth over the last few years. It's bars and restaurants have added about 24,000 jobs a month in the past year. So this is clearly an anomaly in that space, too.
Right. So people in that industry, hold on, because you've actually been adding jobs. But why would the unemployment rate fall with the jobs lost?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there are two separate surveys that are done to produce these numbers. One is a survey of employers, actually the companies and organizations that hire people. And in that survey, if you're temporarily out of work for reasons such as hurricanes, that job is counted as lost. However, in the unemployment rate survey, which is, you know, the headline unemployment rate of 4.2%, that's based on a survey of households. And in that survey, if you're only out of work temporarily because your company shut down, for example, for a hurricane, your job is not considered lost. So that number is important this month because it fell again, really reaching the lowest since 2001. That's the sort of the silver lining of this report, right, and indicates that the trend is still pretty strong in the labor market.
You know, it could be some people who've stopped looking for work, but that's pretty darn good to have that low rate. Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, on the new jobs report today. 33,000 jobs lost, but again, probably because of weather, will bounce back up. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Two weeks after Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico, the island's power grid remains in shambles. Authorities say it will take months to fully restore electricity. In a moment, we're going to hear from the New York Power Authority, which is helping with the recovery efforts. But first, we're joined by Jose Roman Morales in San Juan, Puerto Rico. He is president of Puerto Rico's Energy Commission, which regulates the island's electric power authority, known as PREPA. Commissioner, from what you know right now, what is the state of Puerto Rico's power grid? How many people are still without power?
Well, there's a substantial amount of citizens without power. We're talking about the latest number that I had, up to 90% of the island without power.
Up to 90% of the island. So millions of people without power still.
Yes, that is correct.
And do you have a sense at this point of how long it's going to take to restore the power?
I'm afraid I don't have an answer to that. I mean, the utility is working as diligently as possible. The Army Corps of Engineers is here as well as FEMA, and they are all working to get energize the island back.
So why did Puerto Rico have such a catastrophic failure of its power grid as a result of Maria?
One thing to always remember is that Maria was a very strong hurricane. Now, there were some issues before the hurricane. There were some maintenance issues that PREPA had. For example, there was a lot of backlog on the tree trimming. And obviously that creates problems. Without a storm, any branch that makes contact with the line will create issues. And with a storm, once the trees start falling or the branches start falling or the debris start going everywhere, then you're going to have a problem with the transmission lines as well as the distribution system.
So there's the issue of trees falling on the lines. What about the strength of the lines themselves? Could they have been stronger before the storm?
There was a maintenance issue. PREPA was on a reactive maintenance mode, not in a proactive maintenance mode that typically is what you want to be in. The issues with liquidity, had issues with personnel to be able to provide that preventive maintenance. If that would have been implemented on time, it would probably have helped, but I do not have the answer because I do not want to presume something that wasn't a fact.
How did PREPA get into so much debt?
It's years of happening. Their basic rates or the bill wasn't raised since 1989. And as long as there were a lot of sales of electricity, of the commodity, then you have a robust business. But once industry started leaving the island and the economy of the island started changing, the economies of PREPA were not the same. PREPA started issuing bonds to either finance capital improvements, and in some cases might have financed operational costs. And that in 2014, when PREPA's credit was downgraded, then PREPA didn't have any more access to the capital markets at a reasonable price.
Well, do you think that Puerto Rico is going to rebuild its grid in the way that it should rebuild its grid, and is going to have the money to do that?
I don't want to get into hypotheticals, because right now we are in the phase of trying to get on the emergency. So we are on the phase of making sure that the critical loads, that the hospitals have energy. And we're still working towards that. The commission is committed to making sure that the grid is built so that it's a modernized grid and a resilient grid that is a 21st century grid. That is something that the commission is committed to doing and overseeing.
That's Jose Roman Morales, who is president of Puerto Rico's Energy Commission. Thank you for joining us, and good luck in getting power back to the people of Puerto Rico.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, joining us now is Gil Quiñones, who is the president and CEO of the New York Power Authority, which has a team in Puerto Rico to assess the situation and help reconstruct the grid. Gil, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And you visited Puerto Rico shortly after the devastation caused by Maria. What did you see there when it comes to the power grid?
Yes, we did that on September 22nd under the leadership of Governor Cuomo, who decided right off the bat to go to Puerto Rico and help when he received a request from Governor Rosselló of Puerto Rico. And we saw a lot of damage, mostly on the transmission and distribution system. And, you know, it's really more stark when you see it in person rather than through TV or cable.
Now, you say the transmission and distribution system. Do you mean basically that there are a lot of power lines down?
Correct. There are a lot of power lines down. There are sections of the city during our visit in San Juan that was completely flooded. And, you know, we left 10 New York Power Authority experts and two Department of Environmental Conservation drone pilots to help in the damage assessments. Since then, Governor Cuomo asked us to add, which we did. We added another 10 experts, generation, transmission, distribution, power experts from the Power Authority to work side by side with the employees of PREPA, the utility in Puerto Rico, and also lately the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So we're a resource. We provide technical operational expertise and troubleshooting expertise to both PREPA and the Army Corps.
Is there any problem with generation in Puerto Rico at this point?
Generation suffered some damage, but relative to the transmission and distribution, minimal damage.
Is there anything that they could have done to be better prepared for a major hurricane when it comes to the power lines? Because you can't really put them underground, right? That you would have faced the same problem because of flooding.
That's correct. Although what we hope as they rebuild the lines, just like how we did it in New York, when we built back the grid on Long Island and the New York City metro area, we made sure that they were going to be built much stronger and more modernized so that it can withstand similar events in the future. So we hope that the federal government will fund not only a restoration, but really a hardening, rebuilding, and modernization of the grid in Puerto Rico.
So no more wooden power poles?
Well, there still could be, but there are many techniques to harden the grid, stronger cross arms, bundling of the conductors, sectionalizing portions of the grid. So there are many techniques. You could put underground certain select part of the circuit. So things that we did here in New York post Sandy, those things should be considered in Puerto Rico.
How different is what happened in New York after Sandy and what's going on in Puerto Rico post Maria when it comes to the power grid?
There are similar things and there are differences. I would say the similar thing, for example, Long Island has about 3.5 million people also, very similar to Puerto Rico in terms of land area and type of grid. It's very similar. But in New York, we suffered more flooding, coastal flooding, than Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico suffered a lot more wind damage because Maria stayed longer and it was a Category 4 hurricane that kind of lingered and really damaged transmission towers and a lot of distribution poles and substations, etc.
Is there anything that could happen in New York that could cause power to go out for as long as we're seeing in Puerto Rico?
I don't believe so. You know, we have done the hardening and the rebuilding here in New York. Of course, you know, you can never predict this severe weather events nowadays, but we have been rebuilding. We have been building our systems back better here in New York, so hopefully we're better prepared.
That's Gil Quiñones, who heads the New York Power Authority. He and his team are helping Puerto Rico rebuild their electric grid. Gil, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
The film Blade Runner opened to mixed reviews in 1982. Eventually, it came to be considered a science fiction masterpiece and is now included in the Library of Congress's National Film Registry. A sequel, Blade Runner 2049, opens in theaters this weekend. Harrison Ford returns, so does director Ridley Scott, and Ryan Gosling joins them as a new Blade Runner. Reporter John Kalish has our story about how the screenwriter Hampton Fancher helped craft both films.
The original Blade Runner is set in 2019 in a rain-soaked dystopian version of Los Angeles. Harrison Ford plays a burnt-out cop named Deckard who gets tapped to hunt down four replicants, human-like robots working as slaves in outer space, who've escaped to Earth. He falls in love with a replicant named Rachel.
I'm Rachel.
Deckard.
It seems you feel our work is not a benefit to the public.
Replicants are like any other machine. They're either a benefit or a hazard. They're a benefit, it's not my problem.
May I ask you a
Blade Runner is based on Philip K. Dick's 1968 novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Its journey to the silver screen wouldn't have happened without Hampton Fancher, who wrote the first drafts of the screenplay. Fancher met Dick in the mid-1970s.
I think he was clinically paranoid. Other books he tried to pimp me on. He wanted me to read them and do those.
Fancher gave up hope of turning Dick's novel into a movie. Then an actor friend managed to secure the film rights, and Fancher's girlfriend, actress Barbara Hershey, talked him into writing the screenplay. But Fancher clashed with director Ridley Scott while Blade Runner was being shot and asked that his name be taken off the credits. The first time he saw the finished film was at a screening for Movie Industry Insiders.
I was prepared for disaster. And the second it started, as soon as you saw that L.A. nightscape, everybody lost their cookies. It was like, ugh! I'm not exaggerating. There was a palpable joy in that theater. They loved it.
Thatcher's life has been a series of adventures. He went to Spain as a teenager and became a flamenco dancer. He returned to the U.S. and acted in dozens of major TV shows. His story is featured in Escapes, a documentary about Thatcher directed by Michael Almereyda.
Hampton is one of the natural daredevils I know. And the way he's chosen his path, fallen off the path and fallen back on various paths, is in defiance of a conventional life. And ultimately, I think it served him well.
Thatcher has taught screenwriting in New York, but when producers went to work on the Blade Runner sequel, no one called him. So Thatcher's agent urged him to reach out to director Ridley Scott.
I'm not going to call anybody. And then friends found out. They read about it or something. And Hampton, this is your idea. You know, you're the one. And I said, stop. I'm not going to do anything about that. My pride. So it was out of the question. I put it out of my mind, actually.
Thatcher had just finished a book of short stories in 2012 when his publisher called and said there was room for one more. So he took a scene that didn't make it into the original Blade Runner and turned it into a short story.
It's a Friday afternoon. I just finished writing it. And the phone rings.
Ridley Scott was on the line.
And he says, hey, Hampton. And I said, oh, Ridley, you finally hit the bottom of the barrel, didn't you? You must be desperate. And we laughed. And he said, so, you got any ideas?
So Thatcher read Scott the first paragraph of the just-completed short story.
And he says, can you come to London? Bingo.
On the flight to London, Thatcher worked on the narrative line and later wrote the first draft of the screenplay.
All right, I'm going to ask you a series of questions. Just relax and answer them as simply as you can. You're reading a magazine. You come across a full-page nude photo of a girl.
Is this testing whether I'm a replicant or a lesbian, Mr. Deckard?
Just answer the questions, please.
Just as genetic engineering was used to produce replicants, Thatcher's DNA somehow became a part of Blade Runner 2049, says Michael Almereyda.
It's a great trajectory that his name is still on it and that he's recognized as the co-creator of the story. So it's not incidental. Whatever he did, it's not incidental.
Thatcher, now 79, says he has four or five finished screenplays up his sleeve.
At this point, because there's some knocks on the door, maybe I'll open the door and one of those things will come to fruition.
A new life awaits you in the off-world colony. The chance to begin again in a golden land of opportunity and adventure.
For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish in New York.
And Blade Runner 2049 opens in theaters this weekend. This note, this afternoon on All Things Considered, Bob Mondello is going to review another film opening today, The Florida Project, the second movie from Sean Baker, who shot his first award-winning film on an iPhone. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Jeremy, is any of this film like in the English countryside that I should... I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.